Tonight, Debbie tells her story, and I have been looking forward to this for so long that I'm not going to go on too much longer here. I'm going to get her up here as quick as possible. Please welcome Debbie.
Hi, everybody. My name is Debbie, and I am an alcoholic. Good to be here. It's good to see y'all here. And thank you from my home group for coming out for support of me. Well, I got butterflies in my stomach, but they'll pass. This too shall pass. And I was told to tell my story, to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was brought up in Abington, Maryland, and it was a very, very small town. And my father was an engineer, and my mother was a homemaker. And my mother was also an alcoholic. Now, I was a spoiled little brat. I was the only girl, and I got everything I wanted. And I wanted more. And then I became real rebellious. And I was born with a physical disease and a mental illness. And my physical disease cropped up when I was 8 years old, and I was in severe bone pain. And they put me in the hospital, and they didn't have CAT scans or MRIs or anything like that then. And they did, they wanted to get some of my bone. So what it was a long steel rod with a hook on it that they inserted in you and got a sample of your bone. Well, after 7 times, my doctor says, that's it. You're not going to have any more. Now, they didn't put you to sleep for this. And she goes, but we got to do one more. And I said, hell no. And I jumped off the bed and started kicking her in the shin and screaming. Said, I'm not going to do it. And anyway, I did have one more. And I was diagnosed with a very rare bone disease at Johns Hopkins University Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. And I was in severe bone pain. And I had 2 major surgeries. I had back surgery and I had hip surgery. And my mother said, you have 250 stitches in you. I said, oh, wow. And I was in a wheelchair for a while, and I kind of liked it. I got attention. You know, everybody said, let me, we do wheelies and go fast down the hill. I said, let me go, you know. And I don't know, it was kind of fun, you know. But anyway, I went to school. I started going to school. And I wasn't allowed to take gym because my bones are deteriorating. And so I had to go to the library. Now, how I looked at it was that I wasn't a part of them. I could have looked at it was, here's all this world of knowledge, all these wonderful books I could read. Instead, I sat in a chair and folded my arms and thumped my foot and said, hell with this, you know. And so in my rebellion, all the guys in the neighborhood would get together and play baseball and football. Well, I asked them if I could play too, and they said, sure. Well, by the age of 11, I had 12 broken bones. And every one of them, my mother and father would get so pissed off. They said, what happened? I said, well, I was trying to catch a football, and I fell, and I broke my leg, you know. And they said, how many times do we have to tell you you can't play sports? But it was that rebellious nature in me. It was born in me, I think. And then I started running away from home. And my parents said that they had to take some action. And they took me to a juvenile place. And it was a conference with a counselor in juvenile detention. And this is when I first became an escape artist. We were in there talking, and my parents said they just didn't know what to do with me, and they needed some help. And she goes, "Well, Mr. and Mrs. Cook, let me take you out of the room for a minute, and let me talk to you, and then we'll come back in and talk to Debbie." I said, "Okay." And the first thing I looked at was the window, and I opened it up, popped the screen out, and got on the roof and hopped down and was gone. Now, that was my first escape. And then, so my parents had me committed to Seton Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, run by the Mothers of Seton. And Mother Seton was supposed to be a saint, and this was the order of them. And I'm not Catholic, but it was the only institution they could find for a 12-year-old. And back then, it was long-term hospitalization. I was there for 3 years. And the only kind of medications they had back then were like Thorazine. So I did the Thorazine shuffle. I took my Thorazine and I shuffled and I drooled. And I'd see the psychiatrist for 15 minutes every day, and I'd say, "I want to go home." And the maintenance man was in painting the padded room one day. Well, I went in there and just started talking to him, and I was looking for his keys. And I saw him over there in the corner. So I kind of distracted him and grabbed the keys, and I locked them in the padded room. And there was the exit door, so I escaped it. And it was a long driveway down the to the road. So I was running down the driveway, and I said, "I'm free. I'm free at last." And I was walking down the sidewalk, and damn, wouldn't you believe that my psychiatrist caught me and brought me back. Well, I served out my term, and the day I left, my psychiatrist's name was Dr. Kelkenstein. He was a German doctor. And he said, "Debbie, you're no better than the first day you got here." I said, "Thanks." So I came home, and when I came home, my mother left. And how I took it was that she left because of me. That really wasn't the reason I know now. She left because she was an alcoholic and she took off with another man. And my father sat in the chair and he says, "I think I'm going to blow my brains out." And he had a shotgun in the closet. And I said, "Dad, everything will be okay. Please do not blow your brains out." Well, I just froze up. I quit drinking. I quit running away. I quit being rebellious, and I just took over. My fear was that my dad was going to give us away or that he would blow his brains out. That was really my biggest fear. So, in fact, it started the very next morning. We used to have bologna and cheese sandwiches to take to school for lunch and then a little pack of cookies. And so my brothers were big. They were all jocks, and they were involved in football and baseball and wrestling. And I would slap 8 pieces of bread on the counter. and boom, slap, 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 then the blind, slap, 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 then the cheese, slap, 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 and then the mustard, squirt, 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 squirt. And then my father, the first week he took me to the grocery store, he gave me $75 and dropped me off at the grocery store. Well, I had never been grocery shopping before. I bought 7 boxes of Hamburger Helper. I will not ever eat Hamburger Helper again as long as I live. I swear to it. And then I even bought a box of Kraft macaroni and cheese. And I was reading the directions. It says 1/3 cup water or milk. And I put 3/4 cup. And when I spooned out the macaroni and cheese on the plate, it just ran all over their plate. And I just hadn't had any experience cooking. And so when we were invited out to dinner, man, I tell you, that was a treat. And thank God for pizza. So, I don't want to spend too much time. I've almost spent a half an hour. Okay. My first strength was, I was 12 years old, and I asked my parents if I could have a boyfriend. I had a crush on, my brother had a band, and it was a drummer, and his name was Kenny. He had red hair and blue eyes, and I had the biggest crush on him. And he had one on me, too, and I asked if I could go out with him, and they said, absolutely not, you're too young. So I told Kenny, and Kenny says, well, how about if I come to your window at midnight and we'll talk? And I said, great. So he came to my window, and he had a bottle of Boone's Farm strawberry wine. And he said, try it, you'll like it. And I took one drink, and I felt that warmth go down, and I had that automatic euphoric feeling. You know what? I wouldn't give him the bottle back. I mean, that was my first drink. I drank the whole damn bottle. And then my second drink, I have to go back to the hospital. I was out after I was there a couple years. They let me walk on the grounds, and I talked to the landscapers, and I asked him if he would get me a pint of vodka. And I said, buy the pint. And I said, on the second window on that second story. And I said, I'll put a sheet down. They had curlicue bars, so you could punch out the sheet, the screen, and have enough room to put a sheet down. And I said, just tie up the vodka in the sheet, and I'll pull it up. Well, I got my vodka, and I drank it, and I was laughing and laughing and laughing. And this nun walked by, and she goes, my, Miss Debbie, aren't we happy today? That was my happiest day there. Well, I never had one drink in my life. And it set up that obsession and craving that it talks about in the big book. And I got married when I was 18. And it started out to be a disaster. My father said, you can have anything you want, and he gave me the most beautiful wedding in the world. The only problem was he gave me an open bar. And my girlfriend, Kathy, she used to count the drinks I drank. I had 16 doubles. And my honeymoon night was spent in the bathroom. And I'll never forget the cool feeling of the toilet lid, you know. And he said, "You coming to bed, honey?"
No.
And so finally he just gave up asking. And then he was a petty officer in the Navy, and he was studying to be a nuclear engineer. And we moved to New York, and my drinking flourished. But I didn't really start having any consequences then. I didn't get in too much trouble. I wasn't having blackout drinking yet. And then we moved to Charleston, and he went out to sea for 6 months on a nuclear submarine. Well, I partied, and I started having blackouts and started ending up in places that I didn't remember. And all the officers' wives would keep in contact with each other every week to make sure everybody was doing okay. And if they needed any help with anything or anything, well, they hadn't heard from me in 2 weeks. And so they actually had all the officers' wives sent out a search party driving around neighborhoods looking for me. Well, a captain's wife found me. And you know how in front of churches how they have the, like, brick thing where it has what time the worship service is? Well, I was sitting there in a long dress and a shawl and a Bible. What I had done, I had gone to church, and they asked God to help me with my drinking problem, and I got saved. So I preached in the streets in the worst parts of Charleston for 2 solid weeks, days and nights. I'm a little bit of an extremist. That's really when my manic depression came out, too. And so Dale shipped me out to his mother's, and it was in Thompson, Illinois. And the population was 800. There were no trees. All you could smell was cow manure. It was cold as hell. And I thought I was in hell. And she got me a job at the Ford factory plant, and I'd have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and stand out by the road and wait for my ride. And anyway, they put me on this factory line, and all I had to do was put this little spring in this part and use this little instrument and click it in there. Well, I'm just too slow. They come down, and I'd be working on one, and here's 2 and 3 coming down. So I start picking them up and throwing them over on this table over on the other side of the conveyor belt. And then I start pushing them up the conveyor belt. And one thing I noticed in factories that people just don't talk. There are a certain breed of people. And so I finally screamed, "Shut the conveyor belt down!" And he came over and said, "Apparently you can't do this job." And anyway, my mother-in-law wouldn't allow me to drink, and I had no transportation, and I was miserable. So I said, "I'm going to take an overdose." So I took an overdose and no dose. And the shit kept me awake all night. And I had to go to work the next morning. And I said, "God, you're just not helping me." And anyway, so then Dale came back from being out at sea. And I flew down to Charleston. Well, the first thing I did, I didn't buy a pint. I bought a fifth. And I landed up in New York City. I went into a complete blackout. I don't remember how I got there, what happened on the way there. and I called him, and he flew me back down to Charleston, and my mother-in-law shook me, and she goes, "Debbie, why are you doing this?" And I looked at her, and I just said, "I don't know. I really didn't understand why I did it." And so then I started getting jobs. I came to Atlanta in 1980, and my family had a family business restaurant. And they all drank too, so I fit in real well. And I would work at night, and we would always go to this bar after, and I stunk. It was a seafood restaurant. And we wore t-shirts as "I have crabs." And and so all the guys at the bar would go, "I'm staying away from you, lady." Plus, I stunk. You know, I smelled like Old Bay seasoning. We used to get 500 pounds of Old Bay seasoning a month from Spice Company in Baltimore. But anyway, I knew I had a drinking problem because when we were at the bar, they said, "Well, we better get home. We got to get up early and go to work." And I would pretend like I was going home too. I'd get in my car, turn my lights on, turn the engine on, and I'd count them as they left to make sure they were all gone. And then I'd turn my lights off, turn my engine off, and go back into the bar. Well, I had this one slight problem. I couldn't wake up in the morning because I didn't get to bed till 2 or 3 and was supposed to get up at 5. So I said, "Okay, I'll go out and buy another alarm clock." So I had an alarm clock by my bed, and I had an alarm clock across from my bed at the dresser. Well, that still didn't work. I said, "Okay, I'll go out and buy a really big alarm clock with big speakers, and that will do it." Well, guess what? I fell out of the damn bed the next day. And I had one manager that says, "Debbie, I feel like being a father to you, and you need some help." And I said, "I really appreciate it." And I didn't go back to that job. I didn't want his help. And so my drinking continued, and I never had a DUI. Actually, I almost had one DUI, and it was in Chamblee, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and they pulled me over and gave me a breathalyzer test. Well, they took me to the jail, but I was never put in jail. I talked to the captain of police, Chamblee Police Force, and told him that I'd buy him all the beers he wanted at the restaurant. And we started laughing and joking. He goes, "Well, you just stay here and talk to me for a few hours, then I'll let you go." Well, then I got so miserable and so unhappy, and I said, "Well, I'm going to Florida." And I said, "I won't drive, so I won't get any DUIs." Well, in Florida, long story, made sure I got 5 public drunks. And I really believed after the 5th one that they were picking on me. I said, "They just don't like me." And I had to serve a 30-day sentence for everyone. Nobody in my family, none of my aunts, none of my cousins, none of my uncles would bail me out. Everybody was just sick and tired of it. I was too. And so I left and I said, "Okay, I know what I'll do. I'll move to the country." So my girlfriend and I moved to North Carolina. And we moved way out in the country. It was across from a horse farm. And she drank tequila. Well, we both got a job at the same place, and when we get off work, we'd get a fifth of tequila, and we'd sit in the kitchen, and we had mice. And we had all these mice traps everywhere. Well, we start doing shots of tequila, and the mice traps would go off. So, well, there's another mice. And one night, I got so crazy on tequila, I decided I was going to go run with the horses. So I jumped over the fence and ran with the horses. And my friend at the time, she was an alcoholic too, and she was dating this married man. Well, she got so drunk one night that she went to his house and crawled into his bedroom window, and holy hell broke loose. And I said, I don't think North Carolina is the place for us. And so I said, I'm going to California. Well, I traveled all over this country. I've been in almost every state. And it was geographical changes. But the one thing that always followed me, and it was me. And I was miserable inside. I had very guilty feelings about hurting my family, hurting other people, doing things that were against my ethics, my morals. But I couldn't quit doing it. I did not know how. And my aunt took me to an AA meeting, and it was a speaker's meeting. And that's mostly what they had back in the 60s. And I sat in the back, and I really didn't think she was taking me because I had a drinking problem. I thought she was just taking me to show me what she was doing in her life. I said, oh, Aunt Beth, this is just great for you. I bet you just love this. You know? And she never said, Debbie, do you think you have a problem drinking? She never said anything to me. And so anyway, I got a job at Carlos McGee's in Buckhead as being a bookkeeper. And I had a bar comp. Well, you know, that's the best job in the world for an alcoholic. But the only problem was like, I had so much money, and I forget the exact amount I had, but after 2 weeks, it would fill up the whole month. But I was a bookkeeper, so I just shifted it to the next month. But after 6 months, I've used up a whole year's of bar comps. And so anyway, I had heard of AA in Atlanta, and people had talked to me about AA. But this is such a disease of denial. And it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I was powerless. But I thought I had power. I thought I could control it. And time again, I could not control it. So I made a serious suicide attempt. And I was very serious about it. I said, this is going to do it. Well, I woke up in intensive care. After 5 days, I was in a coma. And I had heard about the Biscayne Room. The day I got out of the hospital, I went straight there. And I opened up the door, and a woman by the name of Maggie Harrison, I don't know if it was the look on me or what it was, but she took me by the hand And she took me into the recovery room, and she goes, "Let's pray." I don't remember what she said or what I said. All I knew, I was defeated, and I was surrendering. I needed help, and I wanted help. And I wasn't working at the time, so she said, "You need structure." And she said, "Come down here at 8 o'clock every morning, and I'll put you to work." And it only took about an hour, filling up the Coke machines, cleaning the bathrooms, counting out the change, putting out the ashtrays. And I always had one question for her. At 9 o'clock, we'd sit down for a cup of coffee. And I'd ask her that question. I'd be thinking about it all the day before. It was about something about the program. I spent my life at that room for the first year. My husband at the time was a dealer. I remember I came home one night and I was just so spiritual. I was walking on water. And I opened up the front door, and the pot smoke hit me in the face. Four people were on the couch with mirrors lining up Coke. So I walked through the living room, and the phone rang. They said, "How much is an ounce going for?" I just dropped the phone, ran down to the basement, and here's a couple pounds of different kinds of medications. And I ran down to the Biscayne room. And I don't know this man's name. I can't remember what he looked like. But I told him the situation I was in. And he gave me a key to the Biscayne room. And he said, "You can stay here as long as you need to. Just lock up when you leave." So I stayed there that night till about 3 or 4 in the morning. And then went home, and everybody was gone, and went to bed. I took this program very, very seriously. And I loved it. Because it gave me direction. It showed me a way. And I remember the first step, especially, you have to take the first half of the first step 100%. And I conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And I like that I'm an alcoholic today because I have a design for living. And it says the big book leads us to a power greater than ourselves. Well, I had always demanded things from God. I had never asked for His will. So that was one of the first prayers that I was taught to pray. To ask for His will be done, not mine. And my first year of sobriety, I did my fourth and fifth step. In my fourth step, all I did was write and write and write and write. I had so much garbage in me, so much remorse, so much guilt. I had to get it out. I didn't go by the big book. I didn't go by the 12 and 12. I just had to get the garbage out. And I got a relief from that. And then I shared it with my sponsor. And because that's what they said you're supposed to do. And I remember holding my head down that when there were things that I shared that I had done that I was not very proud of, not very honest things, very dishonest things, very legal things, that I thought I would take to the grave with me. That I was willing to go to any lengths. And you have to be willing to go to any lengths. I mean, there was one particular thing in my life that I had done that I swore I would never tell anybody. I thought it was the most horrific, horrible thing any human being could ever do. But you know what? My sponsor shared some things that she had done. And I started raising my head up and saying, you know, it wasn't that horrible. And I quit beating myself up. We are sick trying to get better. We're not bad trying to get good. And then the sixth step, the defects of character. I listed a number of defects that I had, but I also was told to list the assets that I had. And I was told by my first sponsor to work my defects, to work the first step on my defects, and to work the third step to get rid of them. And then making amends. I made one mistake in making amends. Not one, probably many, but one, I did it in the wrong way. I made amends to the people that I could at the time. And one person didn't accept that amends. And I got very upset about it. And I took it to my sponsor, and she says, Debbie, that's not how you make amends. You clean up your side of the street. Whether they accept your amends or not, that's not up to you. Your part is to make your amends. A lot of amends, there's people, I can remember one job I had, and my girlfriends were bringing me Long Island iced teas from their lunch break to drink. And the first time I had one, I couldn't believe how it kicked my ass. But I got mad at the boss and told him to take this job and shove it and walked out. Well, I don't even remember where the job was or who the man was. And so I had to write a letter to the dear man at the place where I don't know. I am sorry for what I did, and if I ever recognize you any place, I will make amends then. Well, I had a lot of those kinds. A lot of people in my journey have tried to help me. I hitchhiked from Maryland to California. A lot of people tried to help me. But I didn't want their help. I wanted to do it my way. I thought I'd be happy in San Francisco and go to Haight-Ashbury and be with the hippies. And but anyway, going along with the steps, my favorite step is the 10th step. And when I did the fourth step, my sponsor told me, he says, well, you're wiping the slate clean now. And the 10th step, you're going to keep that slate clean. But I have had resentments come up, and I just recently did another fourth and fifth step just about a month ago. And it was a very thorough one. It was a very thorough one. Because even after years in the program, oh, my sobriety date. My sobriety date is 11/27/2000. And I had 11 years. I'm kind of skipping, aren't I? I had 11 years of sobriety and picked up the drink in 1999. And the reason I picked up the drink is because I was going to a pain center and had gotten very addicted to painkillers and didn't go to meetings for a year, laid on the couch, took pills, and walked around naked and started walk out naked outside one day. Richard said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to get some mail." He said, "Debbie, you're naked." And I said, "Oh, okay." But when I picked up the drink again, I went into an automatic blackout. I never did understand that the progression of alcoholism progresses even when you don't drink. And that obsession and craving came back. I drank for 2 weeks, but you know what? I prayed for 2 weeks. And I woke Richard at 4 o'clock one morning. I said, "Okay, I'm ready to go to the hospital." And I was dehydrated, and I hadn't eaten. I was anemic, and they put me in the hospital for 5 days. And when I came back, I had nothing but love shown to me. I was so scared that I would be rejected, that I would be thrown out, that people wouldn't love me anymore, that they wouldn't like me anymore. And anybody that has gone back out, the one thing my sponsor told me to read was on page 11, and as Bill sees it, and in essence it says, all God wants us to do is to try. And not to carry the whole AA on our back. Just try, give up your pride, your ego, and keep coming back. There's just a few minutes left. I had written something. I don't know. I was thinking about my childhood today. And I write this little story. And I hope you like it. And it says, when I was a child, I went into the forest exploring all the beautiful trees, bushes, flowers, and streams. I walked and walked, and then the sun started to set, and I realized I was lost. Fear engulfed me. I did not know in what direction I should go, neither did I ask God to help. I started yelling for help and trying to find my way out. I eventually did find my way out and ran home to feel secure and safe. When I was lost in the many dark years of alcoholism, I was engulfed with fear and anxiety. When I found AA, I was home and safe and secure. With all the help of a sponsor, and you all, I have been given the directions for living a spiritual life every day that I don't pick up a drink. I have been given the keys to the kingdom. And God is all inclusive, never exclusive. Thank God for that. And thank you all for being here. And keep coming back.
Contributions go toward this group and AA is done. Thank you, Debbie. Beautiful. May I have a volunteer to give out the chips?
Hey, Edward. This group, we have chips. system. And if you heard something here tonight you can relate to and want to try this way of life one day at a time, drop your white chip if you want to come to surrender today. Hey, anybody for a white chip? You better not pick up one. Then we got a silver for 30 days. Anybody? 90 days for red. All right. And then we're going to have a yellow for 6 months. And then a green for 9. Anybody for green? And then we have a blue for multiples a year. Anybody for a birthday? Anybody? Blue, blue, blue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any AA related announcements? Hey, Mark.
It's coming up Saturday night. We have a dance here at 9:30 in this room. It's a spring dance, spring clean. The DJ is going to be great. It's going to start at 9:30 to 12. And, it's $8 for couples and $4 in individuals. And, I have a teacher with this family. If anyone like to aid us, you can ask to meet.
Thank you, Mark. And there's a meeting right before that at 8 o'clock. It's the 12 and 12 study group. That's a good one. And you can break from that and have this room looking good just in time to party. Any other announcements? Next week we've got Hal F. His home group is Biscayne. We've had an up group, and pretty long sobriety there, 1974. And then the week after that, the speaker that was telling his story, the night that I walked in here the first time ever, and I didn't recognize him until he was about halfway through his story, but he was one of my customers when he was 13 years old, and I was a bootlegger, I guess, 16-year-old bootlegger. But I figured I'd better pick up a white chip and didn't give it a second thought, and I'm glad I did. And David will be back here Monday after next, and he's from the Mount Vernon group. Okay, so if there's nothing else, anything anybody wants to discuss? I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Ever remind us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Thomas Finn, would you take us out, please?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Keep coming back. It works if you work.
It works.
Be work.
I'll wash my slip last night.
And my family's here, so I'm like.
And I remember David.
I'm
here, too, yeah.
It's kind of falling down a little bit. I got family, too.
Yeah, but they didn't drop 3.5 hours to come see.
So?
Hey, my mom.
Good, tell her I said it was up.
I know, right?
Yeah, Molly.
I know. Yeah. Ready to go see my mom.
Oh, okay. Yay. You're going to be good. Okay, you can do it.